Special guest now joining us, the book called The Athletic Trap. He's the author of How College Sports Corrupted the Academy, Howard L. Nixon II joining. And Howard, first thing I want to do is welcome you. This book from Johns Hopkins University Press in beautiful Baltimore. And I want to congratulate you on this because a lot of thought-provoking stuff in here. And the NCAA right now is in the headlines, sometimes for the right reasons and many times for a lot of the wrong reasons. And Howard, this book is very timely because we're at a crossroads here.
I think so, although I have to say that people thought so many times previously in the history of college sports because it's been commercialized and had lots of problems, has had lots of problems for over a century, I mean, almost from its beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
I think this time, I mean, there are both tremendous threats to the NCAA and big-time college sports, some of them from within, some of them from without. I've written about what I call asteroids. I mean, actually, I borrowed the term. But, you know, it's these kind of unforeseen and uncontrollable forces that can really bury you if mm-hmm. you don't prepare for them. Of course, with asteroids, even preparation doesn't help if you're too late. I think that within the sports establishment, they're killing themselves, too, because there's this arms race that they just can't spend enough. And so it's really creating havoc. Presidents will tell you that college sports is out of control and there need to be measures taken. The NCAA president talks about his concerns about the arms race, but nobody does anything because it's an arms race. Nobody wants to voluntarily de-escalate because you're afraid other people will get ahead of you, other institutions will get ahead of you, other programs will jump over you. It's really costing institutions, universities, tremendous amounts of money, and in some cases, money they really can't afford.
What I wonder is, where is the point of no return? And I wonder how close we are to the point of no return.
You wonder about that. I mean, arms races, even the origin of the term is, of course, in the idea of the nuclear arms race. And, you know, eventually the United States and the Soviet Union realized that they couldn't keep competing and building more and more arms, and especially the Soviets. It was a very big part of their budget. And, of course, it was an increasing part of our budget. Well, you know, athletics is comparable in a way. And the question is, you know, when will reason prevail? And I don't know that it's going to be reason that comes about through kind of a logical, careful, analytical process. I think it's these asteroids that are kind of these uncontrollable things that, like the NLRB ruling regarding Northwestern, that may have larger implications. These antitrust suits that are being brought by people like Sky Kessler, who's a labor lawyer,
mm-hmm.
the O'Bannon suit,
mm-hmm.
which challenges the right of the NCAA, essentially, and to keep money that athletes are making for the universities.
As you point out in your book, we are a far cry from the era of where the coach made a living wage
right.
to the point now where, and you talk about, I was reading in the book last night about the number of coaches based on the 2010 data that you had published here, and here we are, we're 4 years down the track from that, but half of the coaches in the country, or a good portion, were making over $1 million. I think the number was 26 or so making over $2 million, and those
yeah,
numbers yeah. just continue.
Yeah, I can't even keep up with the numbers.
Yeah.
I usually have to keep looking for the most recent numbers. This is the arms race. I call that the Star Wars arms race. I've written about it. It's trying to get the star coach. Who's going to transform the fortunes of your athletic teams? And it's costly. I mean, it's costing more and more and more. I mean, it's driving the salaries into the stratosphere. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes story a few months ago, I think, on Nick Saban in Alabama. They interviewed the president of Alabama. And you know, I don't have a perfect recall of what he said, but essentially he talked about Nick Saban and he said he was his university's best investment. And the interviewer said, best investment? He said, yes, best investment. To me, that demonstrated what my book is about, The Athletic Trap, and this idea that people get caught up on a campus, the presidents, the trustees, the others, get caught up in athletics in a way that really distorts the way they look at athletics and basically in relation to the rest of the university. In this case, it kind of shows you either he was just saying that to keep the Alabama faithful happy or he was saying it because he really meant it. But in either case, it was really problematic because it suggested the kind of skewed priorities and perceptions that this athletic trap can cause. And the university would not dream of paying top professors what Nick Saban is being paid, nor would the trustees dream of paying him as president what his football coach is paid. This is this corruption of the integrity of institutions. It's a distraction from their basic purposes.
It does come back to purpose, because here's my belief, and I know from reading your book, you might be on the other side of where I'm at, but the thing I love about your book that I told you is I'm not a coach-worshipping guy. Here's the thing I know about those guys. Those guys are glorified PE teachers, and if you came out and you said the cap that you guys can make is 100 grand, every single one of those guys would get back in line and reapply for their job. That's the way it is. But because it's a free marketplace and people are going to say, well, it's a free marketplace, you know, salaries are going to be what they are and they're going to continue to escalate and this and that. And my argument is that it's immoral. One more point to you, and then I want you to hear where I'm coming from. And sure. Then I want your thoughts. The other side of this is, on my show, I'll say to people, I don't think we as sports fans take time enough to go, hey, you know what? The university doesn't exist because the football team's there. The football team exists because, ultimately, the university is there, and it's tied to over 100 years of tradition and all that encompasses. Otherwise, it's just a minor league football team, and who cares about it? So let's back up for a second here. Let's just pull the lens back. Is there a place for somebody like me who says, I enjoy my college football, my college basketball, I do want to see my team win. I don't want to see my team win at all costs. I like what it was. I'm not so sure I like what it's become. In fact, I know I don't like what it's become. It's become professionalized. It's become almost indentured servitude now, the way these athletes are driven by these millionaire coaches and these administrators who have unbelievable pressure to win. And I look at these athletes and I say to myself, Howard, why would that be fun? What would be so alluring? Aside from a shot in playing pro sports, what would be fun about having all your time spoken for, which is what it is now? Is there a place for somebody like me who says, I want balance. I want to see this be a part of our university. And yet at the same time, and I want academic folks to be sympathetic to that. So I don't want it pulled one way or the other. I want it down the middle. Am I too idealistic?
It's difficult to get it to be where you want it to be, but I think there are ways to change college sports to make it at least more honest and open. Talk about, for example, the pay issue in college sports and the free marketplace and big-time college sports. Well, it's not a free marketplace for the athletes.
No.
They're the only ones who aren't the pros. Then, of course, we have this NLRB ruling, and it's really raised the hackles of a lot of folks, and they said, you know, this isn't college sports to be talking about athletes as employees. And my view of it is this. I think what we need to do, and this is the model I've proposed, and I've actually been working on refining it since the book came out, but I think we need to partition college sports. And it isn't really so radical when you think about it, because I think we're moving in somewhat in that direction anyway, because of the rise of the super conferences. Now we're down from 6 to 5 super conferences. And it's about the money. No question, it's about the money. This is the business of college sports. They're all about the business, and people make decisions based on business considerations about money. Here in Maryland, we're seeing Maryland close out its long tenure. I mean, they were a founding member of the ACC, and they've moved on, and it's very open. Look, we're moving for the money. That's going to be that part of college sport. You're not going to get rid of it. But my thought is, okay, let's reorganize it to make it more honest. And it can continue to be the kind of entertaining realm that it is for the sports fans. But in reorganizing it, I think what we need to do is create these, use John Lombardi's term. He used to be the president at Florida and LSU, and he had a great idea. You know, create these semi-autonomous, he was focusing on football, and he called them university football corporations. They're not-for-profit, but they're semi-autonomous, kind of like the university hospital. Basically, you're kind of cutting it off, but not completely severing the cord that connects these big-time programs to the university. Now, my view is you make them have to be self-sufficient. And in this realm, athletes are employees, like the NLRB ruling says they should be treated as. Very few schools and programs can support themselves. But, you know, it's going to cause some belt tightening, this might put an end to this arms race, too, if you say, look, you're not getting any subsidies. You know that 23, I think it's 23 out of 228 Division I programs make enough money without subsidies to pay for themselves. That's 23. That's about 10%, a little less than 10%. 16 of those 23 still take subsidies because they can never have enough money. Well, what if you said, okay, no subsidies anymore? We're not paying for athletic scholarships. We're not paying for anything. You've got to generate your revenue yourselves as an entertainment enterprise. That's going to leave several dozen programs at this big-time realm, which will provide plenty of entertainment. After all, how many teams are in the NFL or Major League Baseball, et cetera?
That's right.
Then all the rest are in what I call the new NCAA. And you know how it's organized? Like Division III. No athletic scholarships either. Need-based scholarships. People playing sports because they love it. You know, there's a lot of that going on in college sports. It's called non-revenue college sports, or it's called women's sports in a lot of places, but also the same as non-revenue men's sports. But there's also a way of reorganizing this. These programs and their personnel would be embedded in the overall structure of the university. No more athletic departments, okay? You have athletic directors, coaches, other athletic personnel in student affairs, or you might have the compliance director in the legal counsel's office because that's where it should be, so there's no conflict of interest. You have the medical folks in the health center, et cetera. I mean, it would look very different. Now, you know what? There are people who would still enjoy showing up on an afternoon, you know, a lazy afternoon, beautiful sunny day, to watch a baseball game or even a football game, et cetera, at this level. It would be about the players. That's the difference between that segment, that partition of college sports, and the big-time division, the super conference division, which is about entertainment. And there, you need to protect the rights of, as I call them, athlete students rather than student athletes. And there, the NLRB ruling makes perfect sense.
Well, it does. And by the way, as for the whole term student athlete, which I think is a misnomer, and look, yeah. I've been around a lot of guys who have come through the University of Tennessee, this team I cover, and gone through other Southeastern Conference schools, which are big money makers, as you say, and and are corporations within the university framework, even though they don't pay taxes. Boy, I would love to have a little piece of that world.
That's another one of those asteroids. Some congressman starts meddling and saying, hey, you know, we ought to start thinking about, or judge says, we ought to start thinking about taking away the antitrust protection.
Right.
And in fact, college sports kind of lost some of that. It lost its opportunities to operate as a monopoly, at least in terms of television contracts back in the 80s. They used to control those in football.
That's
right. They lost that, and what happened? The super conferences kind of filled in the void, and they kind of took over.
Well, you talk about in the book how they went to the CFA model, and,
right,
and then that became not enough. That wasn't sufficient. And now we've kicked the can down the road a little bit further, and now each of these leagues has their own network as they're trying
well, not
to.
Not only leagues.
Go ahead.
The Longhorn Network.
Oh, there you go.
A&M is really, really upset because this is a recruiting advantage.
Right.
There are all these rules in the NCAA about recruiting, but they're getting so clever that they're figuring out these ways to get around these things.
Well, of course. It's like anything else with human nature. You give me a rule, I'm going to break it. I just have to figure out how I'm going to do it.
I have, well, you probably recall, I mean, there's a section on that in the Reform chapter about, I remember I talked to a coach a long time ago, and he said, you know, and I think there have been a number of other coaches. Joe Paterno used to say this. I mean, we used to quote Joe Paterno a lot more before recent years because he had some very sage things to say. Just a few rules, but really crucial ones that make sense. I used to be a faculty athletics representative, and, you know, the rule book is unbelievable.
Oh,
I don't know how anybody could possibly follow every single rule because you can't know them all.
I can't believe the NCAA. I can't believe they have the power they do. But I will say this for the NCAA. You go back to the history, to the very beginning, and these are smart people. The term student-athlete, I mean, the reason that it's there, you go to one of their events, you cover one of their events. For instance, you go and cover the NCAA basketball tournament, or you go to a bowl game, and there's an individual up there as a representative, and he'll go, are there any more questions for the student-athletes? And they're coached and trained to say that. And you point out the whole reason behind the term student-athlete is what?
Well, it's to maintain the commercial structure of college sports as it was emerging. It's actually, this all came about in the 1950s when they created the athletic scholarship. And they were trying to embed in college sports the notion of the student athlete as not an employee. So So they were going to compensate them. You know, it was commercializing, so they were going to compensate them. But they have protected this as sacrosanct, this idea of the quote-unquote amateur student-athlete. I talk about shamateurs. I mean, it's kind of, you know, remember the Olympics and the idea of shamateurism in the Olympics?
Sure.
Where, you know, these guys were, think about what this means in that realm. These athletes were supposed to be competing at the highest possible level, but supposed to be purely amateur. Well, who could be purely amateur except if you were rich? Well, in college sports, people are making all kinds of money off these kids. Some of the rules now, they've changed some of them. But, you know, for example, if your coach wanted to give you some money to go see your dying grandmother or something like that, you'd be breaking an NCAA rule.
That's right.
I mean, this is just absurd. It's truly absurd. So we talk about the student athlete. Well, you don't even get a chance to be the kind of student all your classmates can be if you're in a big-time program. And I remember there was this colloquium one time, and Joe Paterno was there, and he was talking about recruiting, and there was tension between athletics and academics. That was the theme of it. And he said, if I've got a kid who wants to be pre-med, I've got to tell him you can't play football at Penn State. It's not realistic. I think there's a lot that you can infer from that.
I appreciated that man's honesty when it came to that note. And obviously, he turned his head on other things, and those things are trouble. And that's a shame, because it mutes a guy's voice like that who really we should look at and say, what sage ideas, as you say, this guy had when it came to what he called the grand experiment. Whatever the grand experiment, however you want to project that in terms of what that meant. As we visit today with Howard Nixon, the book is called The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. It is from Johns Hopkins Press in Baltimore, and you can find it wherever fine books are sold. And it's so timely. It's so interesting. There's so much stuff in here. It is so... Sometimes reading, Howard, is quick and easy. This book for me, and I mean this as a compliment, is very thick. There's a lot of stuff on these pages. There's a lot of numbers. You have a lot of abbreviations at the very beginning of the book because you speak in terms of these abbreviations. And one of the things that you talk about early on in the book is what you call the IGT. And to anybody that's a thinking person, the IGT, I'd like you to define that, but that's really what drives the engine here.
Yeah, the broader concept of the Golden Triangle applies across all of commercialized sports, but in intercollegiate athletics, the IGT is the intercollegiate Golden Triangle. And what is it? It is the sort of partnership, if you will, the connections among big-time commercialized college sports programs, the college sports realm, the sports media, and the business sector, the sponsors, the merchandisers, et cetera, who make money from sports. And the thing to understand about this is that while there may be a number of purposes of college sports for the colleges that compete in big-time college sports, including enhancing the brand of the university, of course, but also trying to attract more students. I mean, there are a lot of ideas building alumni support, et cetera. The fact is that in the media and business sectors, the purpose of getting involved in sports is making money or improving their financial position, their own branding. They don't really have a deep connection to any particular college athletic program, or in fact, if fans started to lose interest in it, to college athletics itself. They would go on to some other kind of business opportunity. This Golden Triangle has a tremendous hold over college sports, and especially the media and business over the sports sector. Their values become the values of the institutions.
That's right.
And their enticements really exert a lot of power over university presidents, trustees, athletic directors, coaches, et cetera.
And we understand it now. For instance, here in the Southeast, they'll start a game, and they do it all over the country. In the middle of the summer, or at the end of the summer, rather, 12 o'clock kickoff over at Clemson, South Carolina.
Right.
Why? Because we have to fill that TV window when South Carolina, or rather when Clemson and Georgia play, or when South Carolina and Georgia play.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we playing games on Thursday nights on the campus while they're all over the country now? Friday night games all over. Why? Because television says We want to create more product. Now, I would ask the living listener who's listening to us today and who's thinking, well, Howard's an anti-sports guy, and Tony, you're kind of a, and let me ask you this, just the listener. I want you to consider this. You tell me if television really cares about you when we have Thursday night games, when in the MAC they're playing Tuesday night games, and the people that have been, let's say a Ball State fan has to travel a couple hundred miles to go to Ball State's campus to watch a game on a Tuesday night. They absolutely do not care about you. All they care about is moving units. And if you choose to watch it on television, more power to you. But as our guest Howard Nixon just said, the minute your eyeballs slide away from that, they'll go jump in bed with something else, and they'll drop these people like hot potatoes. And, Howard, I would submit to you that they don't realize this yet, but those things are close to happening. And here's what I mean. Games don't sell out like they once did. They used to be able to dictate to people in towns like this, this is how much it's going to cost to do business with us. And, by the way, we're going to charge you a rate on top of that if you want tickets. Those days are going by the wayside here, there, and just about everywhere, because – if you look at attendance figures, people are starting to push back and say, hey, whoa, wait a second here.
I made a reference to that early, early in the book. And just a brief reference, we're seeing that. Of course, there's other competition as well. Diversification of sports opportunities for television among sports fans. They could be spending their time not only getting access to those events through other media, being in the stadium or the arena, but they could play fantasy games, they could play video games, they can do various kinds of things. This is one of those issues that's interesting. It's because it's just emerging that could eventually be a competitor to the live event. And television wants to see fans in the stands. It doesn't look good. I mean, notice sometimes when they aren't there, they'll just very quickly move away from that part of the stadium where the stands are empty. They want to create this image of excitement, this entertainment spectacle with everybody wildly cheering, and sometimes they're not there. But can I just address something you mentioned in passing a couple of minutes ago? I used to tell my students in my sports sociology classes right at the beginning of the course, I am not a sports hater. I've played sports. I've been involved in sports. I am one, especially in regard to college sports, who wants there to be some responsibility in how sports are run. And I don't really blame the coaches for taking the money and the students for making very difficult choices when we put so much pressure on them to play these sports and keep their scholarships, etc. But I am concerned about the system. In fact, that's the name of the recent book by Benedict and Cartan about big-time college football. It's the system. I'm a sociologist. I'm primarily concerned about the system and not what specific individuals do, although certainly we can be very concerned when they do very egregious things to hurt people. The worst case of this athletic trap I talk about, of course, was at Penn State. But there are lots of other bad cases, too, whether we're talking about North Carolina, which actually ultimately forced the president, Holden Thorpe, he called him chancellor there in North Carolina, to just throw up his hand and say, I've spent my whole career at North Carolina. This is the culmination of my dreams to be the chancellor of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I can't control college sports. I give up. And so he went to Washington University in St. Louis, where I don't think he has a problem as the provost there to deal with big-time college sports. This is the athletic trap at its worst.
I didn't mean to couch your side of the aisle or where you're coming from. I shouldn't make assumptions like that, so I apologize to you, Howard. And I'm glad that you tackled that, because you do, I think, at the end of the book, as you alluded to earlier, I think you put forth solutions that or where this is going. You know, people used to laugh at Jackie Sherrill all the time as a coach of Mississippi State, and he's bizarre. He's a noted rule breaker, rule bender, if you will. He'd been perfect in the NASCAR world, because as soon as they give those folks a rule, they're trying to figure out how they can bend it. And Jackie stood up one time and he said, you know, you guys are going to laugh at me, but the time is coming in the future. This is where we're going here. The time is coming where we're going to have a super conference, and it's going to look like a mini NFL, and it's going to be set aside from the campus, and we're going to play football, because that's what certain schools want to do. And they want to play football, and they want to play basketball. And you know what? Jackie Sherrill, 25 years ago, people laughed at that. Howard, when they read your book now, you can see it. You can see how, as they started this whole notion, and it is a notion, of a student athlete, and then we move through time, and now we've got a Southeastern Conference where you've got a Texas school in it and a Missouri school, and the only reason those schools are involved in this thing is because they bring television markets, and you've got something like Rutgers in the Big Ten, and the Atlantic Coast Conference, as long as it possibly can be, unless you add a school in Maine, I mean, it's unbelievable how spread out and silly the whole thing has become. And here's who gets lost in all this. As you said before, the student. But I also think that the fan in this modern day is getting lost in this. Because I think the fan, I'm going to go back to something you said, if I can. I think the fan, most fans that I deal with, would be happy going to the baseball game on a Sunday afternoon and it being about
that's a real
being a nice
I mean, that's
day.
A person who really loves the sport.
Right.
They've built these special boxes where people, kind of like this sterile environment, you know, at the top of the stadium or in the basketball arena. The elite get to watch the sports from those kinds of venues. And in fact, I've had to be in that kind of venue every once in a while because of my job. I had to entertain people. But, you know, to me, I couldn't wait to get out and hear the noise, feel like I was really at a sports event. But there are an awful lot of people there. Why are they there? They're doing business. They're selling something. Maybe they're, you know, trying to enhance the brand, whatever. I mean, but it's not about the sport. It's about using the sport. So what you're referring to is people who really enjoy watching a sports contest as sport. In the big-time commercialized world of sport as entertainment, that's not everybody, that's for sure.
No, it's not. But I think many people, I don't think they realized where this thing was going in terms of the way they've just drug everybody, whether you want to go or not. Because it's really, if this is your university, and you're wherever you are, Ohio State, Michigan, wherever it is, you have no choice but to now partake in the big-time professionalization of this. But I don't think it's better for a spectator. I'll tell you this. When you walk into a modern stadium in college sports and they are bombarding you with advertisements from the moment you get in there because they have to monetize every single moment you're in there. When I open the phone lines and we talk about that with folks who can remember when you could actually go and think, you actually had a free moment to contemplate what you were seeing. People long for those days. Now, I don't know if they can ever come again. Maybe they can in a simpler world like you're talking about. You put forth at the end of your book your suggestions, your recommendations for this sort of new tier of what we could see. How far away do you feel like we are, Howard?
I think we're moving in that direction, what I call the super conference partition. We're sort of there in some ways. It's just a matter of the NCAA's kind of getting detached from this. You think about college football. When you hit bowl season, the NCAA has virtually no control over that.
Right.
I mean, that's all in the hands, most recently, of the BCS, and then we'll go to the playoff system, et cetera. These are the conferences who are running that. They're filtering the money. You know, the thing that keeps the NCAA in charge of college basketball is the fact that it negotiates the contracts for March Madness. I think that we are clearly moving in the direction of super conferences, and it's the problem is this. The chance to be seen by so many people and the chance to make big sums of money from TV contracts is very alluring. And so institutions keep aspiring to be there. I don't worry about Michigan, USC. I don't worry about Alabama, for that matter, Texas, Ohio State. They got plenty of money. Whatever the configuration of college sports, they're going to be near the top. They've got the money. They've got the support, et cetera. It's all those schools that are wannabes.
Yep.
Who are fringe in the highest level of college sport or trying to move up to that level, either the mid-majors. And who is it costing? It's the students. This is a point that I tried to make in the book, too. Students are and their families are not even aware of how much they are supporting college sports. Mm. You know that at a number of mid-majors, upwards of 80 to 85% of the athletic budget comes from mandatory student fees.
Say that again. I want people to hear that.
From 80 to 85% of the athletic budget comes from student fees, not from revenue directly from sports activity. Shocking. The USA Today started publicizing this. My own institution was covering up that information, and it got named in that article, and it quickly changed its way of doing business, and it started publicizing it. At our institution, we were charging $800, $850 a year for student athletic fee. You're talking about morality. How moral is that when we know that students are running up bigger and bigger debts to be able to attend college? Is that legitimate?
Absolutely not, especially at a time when I look at the cost of a college education today.
Right.
And I hate to say this because you're a professor and I'm a college graduate and I love education and I believe in it. I continue into adulthood reading as much as I possibly can about several different subjects. My education, as far as I'm concerned, only started when I walked off a college campus. I mean, when you walk into
That's good. You learned what you were supposed to learn.
Well, there you go.
It never ends.
Here's the thing, though. I wonder how much that college education is worth today. I know that's another subject altogether.
It is, and I'm not as far from you as you think in terms of my own attitudes. It's a bit embarrassing, actually.
This work is needed. There's about, how many would you say of those? Probably 30 off the top of our head that are going to be able to afford, no matter what they want to do, they'll always be able to find the money. But after that, I have had guys that are at other universities or have left here and have gone on to Mac jobs at all. And they tell me, if you're in the Mac and you go to a bowl game, that's a money loser. You lose money on that.
Yeah, you do. You do. Because this is the dilemma. My university made it to the finals the championship level of college football, rather. And it had to raise extra money to be able to afford all these trips for the playoffs. Some of the mid-majors will also make themselves, in fact, the term that is used by Benedict and Cartan is sacrificial lambs. And in fact, it was their little case study was about my university. It was about being willing to go out and play and become a sure victory for some big-time team.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you do it? You do it because of the guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it still doesn't balance the budget.
It's so interesting because I am in business. If I ran my business like that, I wouldn't be in business very long.
In college sports, it's a whole different story. A lot of these institutions do not have the money. The money that they get often, as I said before, comes from students and mandatory fees. There's a peculiar, I don't know if you'd call it logic, model of the financing of college sports. And this arms race is deadly. But it keeps saying how deadly it is, but nobody's wanted to de-escalate.
Isn't that a great point?
Or not very many anyway.
Howard, let me ask you this on the way out, because people heard you say earlier, this new tier, this new tier, this new tier. And I've had people ask me this, because I'm a guy that says, instead of giving something to someone that they can't access, and what I mean is many, not most, not all, but many. Many is a good word to use here, because I think many is accurate. Many Division I athletes, football players, basketball players at all, these revenue-generating sports, are brought onto a campus, and they're not capable of accessing the free education that's given to them. And I don't mean that the way it sounds, but it is
true.
And so here's where I'm at. I say, why don't we take the value of that education, instead of paying it to the school for something that's not going to be accessed, give it to that player. Put it in a trust. If you stay here 2 years and you do what we want you to do and you stay out of trouble, you get this much. If you stay here 3 years, you get this much. If you stay here 4 years, you're a good, solid citizen, yada, yada, yada. Hopefully you learn something along the way. And if you want to pursue some sort of education on the side, we'll help you there as well. But people say to me, Howard, they say, you can't do that because then the women in the non-revenue sports, the men in the other, the swimmers, the track athletes, the other folks are going to want theirs. Howard, how do you manage? How would this happen and still be legal?
Obviously, there may have to be some modifications of laws. And the courts have certainly created exemptions at times. But my answer is this partitioning. And you take a tiny segment of college sports and turn it into this separate entity. As I said, it's kind of like the university hospital, these semi-autonomous, self-supporting entities. And anyone who can generate enough revenue to be there, men or women sports, could be there, football and men's basketball. But everybody else gets treated very fairly. I don't think, in fact, the way that things have evolved, because of the influence of football, men have been deprived of playing college sports because of the need for gender balance in programs. Well, I mean, I think you're going to have less problem with that when you're not having any particular sport disproportionately use the resources available in athletics. So you have men's and women's sports. You put more money into it so students can play, and I mean play, right? Not work at, but play sports of various kinds. And the whole financial calculus is different. The whole rationale is different. But in the other realm, there are issues that are brought up about antitrust, about gender equity, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of problems to resolve. But unless we start thinking about, seriously thinking about and putting down on paper and starting to negotiate about different ways of organizing college sports, then we never have a chance to figure out what can work.
That's a great point, and that's a great spot to end. Howard, on the way out, as Howard Nixon, so nice to give us a few minutes. The book is called The Athletic Trap, How College Sports Corrupted the Academy. It's from Johns Hopkins Press. On the way out, anything else you want to add today? I'm going to give you the final word. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say thank you. I just hope that people keep their minds open and be prepared perhaps for some more surprises in the coming years.
Extremely well put. And one thing we've learned about surprises when it comes to this, whether it's conference realignment or whatever it is, that case up in Northwestern, they happen in the blink of an eye.
They do.
So it's great talking with you. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you very much for having me.